This is Audible.
Harper One and Harper Audio present Pathological, the true story of six misdiagnoses by Sarah Fay. Read by Gabra Zachman. For everyone who's been diagnosed, and misdiagnosed, and overdiagnosed. Prologue. The slower we walked, the more I seemed to sweat. Summer. Chicago. The two of us wandering the streets around Northwestern Memorial Hospital looking for the inpatient psychiatry unit where Dr. H said I could find help. I'd left him a message. He hadn't called back. The buildings seemed dislocated and distant. Doctors and nurses in scrubs passed us on the sidewalk. Their voices cracked against my chest. A cab honked. A truck started up, billowing exhaust. I heard the strain in your voice when you asked why the psychiatric unit wasn't where Dr. H said it would be. Worry weighed down the skin of your barely aging face. People said you looked 50, though you were in your 70s. The families, people say. The families go through hell. I'll never know what it was like for all of you. So much of that time I spent alone, trying to understand the six diagnoses I thought were real. This isn't a classic mental illness memoir. That kind of memoir is a quest story. From the beginning, our hero is exceptional. She's a debutante, or a celebrity, or a genius, or at the very least, she attends an Ivy League school when her enviable potential is dashed by mental illness. Her journey is extreme. She must leave the ordinary world in search of the elixir that will ultimately cure her. Trials hinder her attempts to find it. She's committed to a psychiatric facility, or she becomes a professional mental patient, a victim of the psychiatric industrial complex. Of course, she triumphs, ending up in the light, elixir in hand, accepting medication or getting off medication, finding true love or God, discovering her illness was physical, thank goodness, not mental after all, devoting herself to meditation or some other supposedly natural remedy, or finding a brilliant physician or free-thinking therapist who saves her. On the book's final pages, she's no longer ill or has embraced her illness. She's rejected her diagnosis or accepted it. My path wasn't that clear. I went to a good university and may or may not have shown promise. I wasn't a professional mental patient. I wasn't a victim. Doctors didn't find a physical cause. Many elixirs were tried. Food, alcohol, exercise, various therapies, natural remedies, and finally, psychotropic drugs. The result was pain, monotony, confusion, and messiness. Yes, I was told, with certainty one after another, I had anorexia, major depressive disorder, MDD, anxiety disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, bipolar disorder. Yes, I almost died. But I was a willing participant. No one brainwashed me. I believed in and accepted those six diagnoses, adopted them, thought in terms of them, identified myself as them, medicalizing my difficulties and discomforts, pathologizing my emotions and thoughts and behaviors. Embracing a diagnosis can be a good thing. It can increase the likelihood that a person will get help. It can lead someone to find a community of people who suffer from the same diagnosis. It can empower a person. But it led me into a spiral. Each diagnosis was a self-fulfilling prophecy. The sicker I believed myself to be, the more evidence I found confirming I was sick. The more evidence I had, the more certain I became. The more certain I became, the more willing I was to undergo treatments. The more treatments I underwent, the sicker I believed myself to be. It's too easy to lay blame, but I do. I blame a book, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM. How can I blame pages, words, letters, dots, dashes, lines, marks on paper? Because the DSM is powerful. Jeffrey Lieberman, former president of the American Psychiatric Association, APA, called it the most influential book written in the past century. Sociologist Alan Horowitz, author of DSM, A History of Psychiatry's Bible, writes that it controls the diagnoses we receive and how we think about them. Which might be fine if the DSM had scientific merit, which it doesn't. Some of the most prominent psychiatrists have referred to DSM diagnoses as constructs and placeholders. Others have admitted that they have no reality, pathologize normality, or are made up. As former National Institute of Mental Health Director Thomas Insull put it, we actually believe diagnoses are real, but there's no reality. Alan Francis, one-time chair of the DSM-4 task force, is quoted as saying that DSM diagnoses confuse mental disorder with the everyday sadness, anxiety, grief, disappointments, and stress responses that are an inescapable part of the human condition. Steve Hyman, another former NIMH director, called DSM diagnoses fictive categories and the DSM an absolute scientific nightmare. But I didn't know DSM diagnoses were invented and had no validity and little reliability until it was almost too late. Validity, which is considered the most fundamental principle in medicine, would mean that DSM diagnoses can be objectively measured, which they can't. Reliability assumes that multiple clinicians presented with the same patient can rely on the symptoms listed in the DSM and will consistently agree on the patient's diagnosis, which they can't. It's tempting to fault the DSM's authors, those members of the APA who wielded those words and punctuation marks. How else did so many unproven diagnoses end up on the most recent edition's many, many, many pages? Over the editions, the number of diagnoses and spectrums and subtypes has grown. And grown. The DSM-5 clocks in at 947 pages with 541 diagnostic categories, compared to the scant 132 pages and 128 categories in the DSM-1. The DSM's authors might defend themselves by saying they just want to make sure those who need care receive a diagnosis, even if, they leave this part out, DSM diagnoses are speculative at best. It's also tempting to reproach the psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers who level DSM diagnoses, even though they know those diagnoses are unproven. They claim they have to label a patient with a diagnostic code to satisfy the insurance company and to get paid, even if, they leave this part out, it means letting a patient believe she suffers from a diagnosis that's essentially theoretical. And pharmaceutical companies who have benefited from the DSM's revisions. And the academic psychiatrists and researchers who have profited from and built their careers on pathologizing normal distress. But the words, so convincing, do the most damage. They've taken on a life of their own. The DSM has become, as some say, a work of culture. It's socially sanctioned. Many, many people believe it's a scientifically proven medical manual. It's not. Not even close. I could be the poster child for the dangers of the DSM. I lived through its most significant editions, the DSM's 3, 3R, 4, 4TR, 5, 5TR, and received 6 of its many, many diagnoses. I call them misdiagnoses because all DSM diagnoses are misdiagnoses, i.e., incorrect, inaccurate, inadequate. They were created by loosening criteria, adding specifiers, shifting symptoms, broadening definitions, and lowering thresholds. How could I have so willingly accepted all those diagnoses and taken all those medications? Why did I believe the words that came from the DSM? I asked so few questions, lived with such little awareness. How could I have strayed so far and been so naive? Like so many who have been diagnosed, I wanted an explanation for what was happening to me, inside me, and no one had warned me about the DSM. Pathological is everything I wish I'd known. It's an attempt to help others understand the truth about the DSM diagnoses they or their loved ones might receive. All those years, I wasn't the only one being diagnosed. There were the students with autism and oppositional defiant disorder, ODD, I taught in the New York City public schools. Shubi, a young man with schizophrenia found not guilty by reason of insanity for murder. And the many, many college students who came to my office hours and spoke so unquestioningly about their anxiety disorder, or depression, or ADHD brains. I should explain my preoccupation with punctuation. To many people, punctuation is a tedious part of human existence. But I've spent my life writing and reading and teaching people how to write. Punctuation is the basis for communication. It's how we form thoughts. It's the mechanism behind our digital and written interactions, the vehicle that drives our connections and disconnections. Punctuation, like pathology, orders and categorizes. It tries to make sense of what's otherwise disordered. When I refer to punctuation, I don't mean to privilege standard English. Every language and combination of languages and subtype of a language has its own rules. Spanglish, African-American Vernacular English, etc. Standard English just happens to be my language. Punctuation clarifies. The ancient Greeks put no spaces between words. Their ink-laden papyri were a jumble of letters the reader had to decipher. For example, imagine there aren't any spaces between these words. Sarah would not eat even when threatened with hospitalization. In the 3rd century BCE, the Greek librarian Aristophanes of Byzantium tried to mediate the madness. He used 3 dots to separate phrases. Each dot had a position on the line. A dot in the middle of a line, the comma, indicated a short pause. One at the bottom, the colon, a medium pause. And one at the top, the periodos, a full stop. So many moments in this story call for a full stop, like that day when my mother and I, never finding the psychiatric unit, entered the emergency room. Half full at midday, it lacked urgency. A man rested his elbows on his knees, a plastic bucket at his feet as if waiting for him to vomit. 2 children climbed on the seats as a woman called to them to get down. In the cold of the air conditioning, we waited for my name to be called. A terrible energy surged through me. Overhead, the fluorescent light seemed to pulse in time with it. I was on my 6th diagnosis, bipolar disorder. Already, I'd started to become bipolar. Each emotion, every thought, all my behaviors were signs and symptoms of my mental illness. A low mood meant depression. Chaotic thoughts and speaking quickly indicated mania. My name was called. The intake nurse took my blood pressure, normal, and listened to my heart, normal. She had chubby cheeks and a serious but kind demeanor. My temperature was normal, too. I had no physical aches or pains. After I told her about the darkness and racing thoughts and suicidality, she shifted in her chair and looked at me. Her eyes were tired, exhausted. She said she could admit me to be examined by a psychiatrist. And then what? She sighed. You might be transferred to the psychiatric ward here or at another hospital. She paused. But you don't want that. Part 1. 1. The weight of a comma. It started with a comma and a cold room. The cold room came first. We waited to be seen by our family doctor at Children's Memorial Hospital. My mom sat on a plastic chair across the room. With her head tipped back, resting on the wall, her eyes closed, she took deep breaths, exhaling through pursed lips. I sat on the examination table, waiting for her to open her eyes. The white paper crinkled beneath me as I pulled my hands from under my thighs and crossed them in front of my chest. Goosebumps covered my forearms, making the thin hairs stand on end. My hospital gown, patterned with childish bubbles, though I was about to enter high school, hung loosely below my collarbone. I felt like a child, wanted to be a child, and for my mom to tell me it would all be okay. 4 hours earlier, I'd been on an eighth grade class trip at Indiana University. The trip might have been a blur, except that not eating had made me alert. In one of Indiana's renowned caves, we spelunked in the near dark. Hunger sharpened my senses. The air was moist against my skin. It smelled of earth and dampness. The drip of distant water echoed in my ears. The weight of my helmet pressed against my forehead. The cave was vivid, dreamlike. By the third night, it was as if a scrim, like the one that had hung at the back of the stage during our eighth grade play, The Hobbit, I'd debuted as Gollum, hung between me and my classmates. As they lined up for pizza, a lightheadedness came over me. My stomach churned, though it was empty of food. I took a piece of pizza, let it congeal on my plate, and tossed it in the garbage before the chaperones could see. The next day, just before we were to leave, that same lightheadedness came on. This time, the room spun and my stomach seized. I was going to throw up. I went to one of the chaperones. She told me to sit. "You need something to settle your stomach." She came back with a soda fountain Coke and a styrofoam cup. I brought the cup to my lips. The soda was sweet, bubbly. My stomach did a little flip. Then I leaned over and threw up. She brought me water. I threw that up too. On the bus waiting to leave, I balled up my jacket into a pillow and leaned against the window. My stomach was raw, the taste in my mouth putrid. I put on headphones and pressed play on my Walkman. My classmates' voices became muddled. Then they harmonized, then synchronized with the sound of the Eurythmics song piano keying through my headphones. The bus door suctioned closed. The gears hissed, the engine droned, and we started to move. An hour and a half later, back at our school, my mom was waiting. She'd been told because she wasn't just my mom, she was the principal. Without a word, she put her hands on my shoulders and looked into my eyes. Her stare was serious. She told me to go wait in the car. I leaned against our Chevy hatchback and watched as she quickly welcomed back the other students as they filed off the bus. They smiled and waved to the woman they knew as Dr. McCarthy. Her dark skin and short curly hair often made people question if we were related. My sister was dark like her. Blonde and light-skinned, I took after my dad. My mom followed the students into the school and soon came hurrying out. We put my bag in the trunk. In the car, I waited for her to say something. She put the keys in the ignition. I expected her to drive. She stared out the window. I stared at her. Finally, she asked, "What do you think you're doing?" I didn't have an answer then, or when she asked again in the examination room. I was doing what my body told me to do. My stomach hurt. It didn't want food, so I stopped putting food into it. Not eating brought a different kind of ache, dry, empty. But at least it wasn't the sickening, murky pit. Dr. A came in, his cheeks red and his white hair a little wild. He seemed happy to see us as he went to the sink and washed his hands, chatting with my mom over his shoulder. My mom told him I hadn't eaten in she didn't know how long. He pressed the cold stethoscope against my chest. "Take a deep breath," he said. I did, letting it out through pursed lips the way my mom had. He pointed to the scale. I stepped on. He flicked the weight until it balanced. His cheery expression faded. I didn't know what it meant to have anorexia nervosa. Not in that cold examination room, not in the car on the way home, not in the living room where I sat on the floor smelling the tomato soup and grilled cheese sandwich my dad was making for me in the kitchen. I was only 12 and had grown up sheltered. I attended my mom's school and had 14 kids in my class. TV was rationed in our house. Magazines weren't yet a part of my world. For my family and most of the general public, the internet didn't exist. Anorexic. In the kitchen, my dad and mom whispered. They did that a lot now that they were divorcing. My dad came in with the soup and sandwich on a tray and put it down on the coffee table in front of me. I'd never been allowed to eat in the living room before. Maybe he didn't want me to have to move to the dining room table. Maybe he thought I was that sick. Maybe I was that sick. I brought a spoonful of soup to my mouth and blew on it through pursed lips. It scared me, that word, anorexia. I'd eat. I'd get better. My dad smiled. My stomach churned. The 1980s were the anorexia age. Articles on the dangers of dieting appeared in magazines like 17. Ironically, articles on how to diet had been a mainstay of that magazine since 1948. The well-worn genre known as the eating disorder memoir was in its heyday. Journalists called anorexia an epidemic, though it was reported as affecting fewer than 1% of American girls and women. The vast majority were middle to upper class and white, a statistic that often served as a way to trivialize them as starving themselves to death to be fashionably thin. In anorexia's long history, many have speculated on its nature and causes. The term was coined almost simultaneously by the English physician William Gull and the French neuropsychiatrist Ernst-Charles Lasaigue in the 19th century. Sigmund Freud, who warned against using psychoanalysis to treat anorexia, and his successors thought it might stem from sexual conflict or a defect of the ego, or, I kid you not, the unconscious wish for oral impregnation. Others said it was about control, or self-punishment, or the result of disordered family dynamics, or low self-esteem, or acting out, or the death drive, the Freudian desire to die, or a fear of growing up, a way to prevent the full breasts, womanly hips, and fleshy thighs puberty brings, or vanity, as if bikini season made girls starve themselves until deep crevices formed above their collarbones and each of their ribs could be counted from a distance. By the time Dr. A christened me with anorexia, it was seen as a complex interplay of factors: cultural, beauty standards for women, psychological, psychoanalytic, family theory, and social psychology models, physical, hypothalamic dysfunction, brain lesions, biological, it could be genetic, and historical, shifts in the role that food plays during certain eras. My parents sent me to a therapist. His office was dimly lit. The blinds were always half closed, letting in faint shafts of sunlight that shone on the wall where his degrees hung. Dr. S had a beard and wore glasses. Or he didn't. He's hard to remember. He sat across the room at his desk. I could barely see him behind the stacks of papers and file folders, one of which he took out and glanced through each time I arrived. It was cold in there, too. The air conditioning always seemed to be on high. In my seat on the couch, the fan blew directly on me. That session, like each of our sessions, was long, but I wanted to do well for him and for my parents and to get better. Most of the time, we didn't say much. He said I was anorexic, too. I wanted to say, no, I'm not. I wasn't Sarah the anorexic. Anorexics, he said, dieted. I'd never been on a diet. They weighed themselves. I hadn't been on a scale since the hospital. Anorexia, he said, was characterized by a refusal to eat. I didn't want to eat, didn't want to upset the murky pit in my stomach, and I did eat, a little. That afternoon, I thought of telling him I wasn't eating because my stomach hurt. But the office was so dark, and he was so far away, behind such a large desk and so many stacks of file folders, that I just sat there in the cold and counted the goosebumps on my forearms. I was allowed to stop seeing him when I started high school. The murky pit was practically gone, mainly because the wait was over. Weights had been lifted. I'd started at the competitive high school where my mom wasn't down the hall. I'd had my period, which seemed alien and untenable. My parents had separated for good. My sister had gone away to college, so I went back and forth between my dad's new house and my mom's apartment alone. But my sophomore year, the murky pit returned, stronger this time, heavy, black. So I starved it again. I'd been starving it for months, the afternoon I sat in English class and tried to pay attention to what Mr. Baker was saying. Mr. Baker, the teacher I idolized. We weren't friendly, strictly teacher-student. He was brilliant and sophisticated, handsome, with a sharp jawline and profoundly blue eyes. He was the first wheelchair user I knew. In college, he'd been in a car accident while driving a convertible. It flipped over. He'd ended up with a C4 break in his spine, paralyzed from the waist down with restricted use of his upper body. His fingers curved into what's offensively referred to as claw hands. Rarely did he write on the board, and when he did, he held the chalk precariously in the crook of his thumb. The result was a few scrawled words. He was thin, emaciated, really. Rumor had it that he kept his weight down to alleviate his bed sores. He treated us like we were smart and could discuss any film or book, even James Joyce's Ulysses. He introduced me to F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, a book I loved and read twice in a row, wanting to stay in that strange 1920s flapper world. With him, we learned to analyze books and films as texts, finely pieced together, every word thoughtfully chosen, each punctuation mark deliberate. That afternoon, at the front of the room, he pushed himself toward a TV and VCR that had been moved in so we could watch Orson Welles's The Lady from Shanghai. He put in the VHS tape and reminded us to watch for the elements of noir. As the movie played, my stomach contracted, its walls seeming to scrape against each other. I sat up straight, but couldn't follow the movie. The main character had or hadn't killed someone. He loved a beautiful woman. She had a husband. At one point, she and the main character talked about suicide, but what that had to do with the plot, I didn't know. My mind went in circles. Arcs of calories, reels of scenes from the movie, swirls of assignments due. Readjusting my seat, I tried to force myself to focus. It didn't work. Not eating had sapped my energy. All I wanted was to put my head on the table and take a nap. I didn't hunger for his attention. I craved his respect. The class ended. Mr. Baker reminded us about our 10th grade term paper. It wasn't due for months, but he recommended we start thinking about it now. The school stressed the paper's importance in our advancement to 11th grade. If we failed it, we failed the class and might be held back. I thought of the lunch in my locker. 3 slim carrot sticks. Maybe if I hadn't read The Best Little Girl in the World over the winter break, things would have turned out differently. The book's 250 pages, which I read quickly and then again and again, were an education. The novel follows Francesca, a teenager and an anorexic. She renames herself Kessa to signify her transformation into someone thin and in control, and stops eating until she ends up in the hospital with a tube in her throat and being force-fed. On my second and third reads, I skipped the ending, wanting only to know about Kessa. We seemed so much alike. She was white and upper middle class. She got straight A's. She liked the objects on her desk arranged just so. There were obvious differences. Kessa lives in Manhattan. I lived in Chicago. She hopes that by being thin, she'll gain the approval of her ballet teacher. I played field hockey, and my coach couldn't have cared less if I had a long neck and swan arms. Kessa competes with the models in the magazines she collects. I never read fashion magazines. Kessa wants to be clean and unsullied by food, to win a game of her own making in which thinner's the winner. Unlike her, I didn't feel dirty when I ate and wasn't in competition with anyone. She said nothing about a murky pit in her stomach. Stephen Levenkron's The Best Little Girl in the World, 1978, is the anorexia text. It long predates pro-anorexia websites and thinspiration hashtags that teach girls and women to be an anorexic. Like the many eating disorder memoirs published after it, The Best Little Girl in the World was more instructional manual and cheat sheet than literature. Levenkron was a psychotherapist who, after becoming famous as a result of the novel's success, treated singer and drummer Karen Carpenter. Carpenter was the first celebrity anorexic. As half of the musical duo The Carpenters, she, along with her brother Richard, sold over 90 million records and won 3 Grammy Awards. Karen, always in the public eye, was the focus of journalists, especially her appearance. A 1975 review of a Carpenters concert in Las Vegas reported that she looked terribly thin, almost a wraith. It also criticized her for not having worn a more becoming gown. Anorexia fatalities are often the result of cardiovascular complications like bradycardia, an abnormal slowness of the heart, and heart failure due to starvation. Another estimated 20% of anorexics attempt suicide. Carpenter died of heart failure as a result of poisoning from Ipecac, a drug that induces vomiting. According to Randy Schmidt's biography of Carpenter, Levenkron supposedly let her family believe he was a licensed physician. They called him Dr. Levenkron. In reality, he was a therapist who'd written a novel called The Best Little Girl in the World, which had been named a best book for young adults by the American Library Association and was turned into a TV movie, all of which somehow made him an authority on anorexia. I'd like to think he wasn't to blame for her death, or if he was, that the novel is part mea culpa, part redemption story. It's Levenkron's Romana Clay. The novel's other main character, therapist Sandy Sherman, is a thinly veiled version of himself. After Kessa ends up in the hospital with a catheter in her jugular vein that provides her with nutrients, Sherman saves her from herself. Kessa might be seen as the Karen Carpenter Levenkron wished he could have saved, except he published the novel 5 years before Carpenter's death. The book is an exercise in authorial narcissism. By the end, the focus switches so heavily onto Sherman as savior that he replaces Kessa as the novel's hero. At the time, I barely noticed Sherman, only Kessa. I studied her. She taught me how to think. My flesh is revolting. My ribs have to jut out. Food is the enemy. I started to count calories, attaching numbers to apple slices and tallying them in a journal. Weighing myself became routine. I smiled at the scale as the numbers went down. I became nimble in my ability to shift food around my plate to make it appear half empty. At dinner one night, I chewed and spit the broccoli my mother had served into my napkin. The scalloped potatoes were already well hidden under the pork chop. I deftly leaned over and stuffed the napkin into the cuffs of my jeans. After we cleared the table, I went to the bathroom and flushed the broccoli down the toilet. Kessa taught me to lie about my weight and what I'd eaten. Like her, I hid my emaciated body under sweatshirts and pajama pants. We differed only in that she quit ballet, and I stayed on the field hockey team, running miles and doing wind sprints even after my weight hovered near 100 pounds. One night, my mother and I sat at the dining room table having dinner. "Eat your chicken," she said. I wouldn't. "The potato, then." I shook my head. Her response was equally logical. "Fine," she said, standing up. "You'll sit there until you do." I listened as she washed the dishes in the kitchen, pots clanging, plates clanking, the dishwasher opening and closing. This wasn't just like a scene out of The Best Little Girl in the World. It was a scene from it. Kessa, too, had been forced to stay at the table until she finished her dinner. A click, and the kitchen light went off. My mom's footsteps on the stairs were followed by the sound of her door closing. The dining room light seemed dim. The murky pit in my stomach grew. I didn't want to upset my mom, not then, and not on the nights when she came into my room and sat on the edge of my bed and told me about the damage I was doing to my body. It wasn't for attention. I'd much rather have been left alone to eat as little as I pleased. Whereas Kessa retreated and isolated, I had friends and even a boyfriend. Doug was sweet, with dark hair and a Roman nose. He was that rare breed. The well-adjusted teenager, all A's, captain of the tennis team. He got along with my parents. He even got along with his parents. But Kessa was my true companion. One afternoon, I stood in front of the hallway mirror and lifted my shirt. The skin on my ribs hung loose. My mom walked up behind me. I pulled the skin away from my jutting ribs. Proof. Fat. right there between my fingers. The mind believes what it's told. For months, I'd been telling mine that I was fat. See? I asked. Anorexia is from the Greek for the negation of appetite, but calorie restriction and a preoccupation with weight are only a small part of it. Body dysmorphia, an obsession with a perceived bodily flaw, is its core. My delusions, my insistence that my emaciated body was fat, confirmed that I was Sarah, an anorexic. Without body dysmorphia, my eating habits might have been considered fasting. A proponent of the fasting craze would have commended me for trying to produce a feeling of well-being, even euphoria. Though some studies find that fasting increases irritability and other biological symptoms of depression, fasters swear by hunger's positive effects on the brain. They would have told me that ghrelin, the hunger hormone, which is touted as a potential treatment for major depressive disorder, was helping my mood. If it had been 2020 instead of 1988, and I was, say, male and the CEO of a major tech company, my ability to refuse food for days or a week at a time would have been praised as proof of my strength and discipline. But there's a difference between fasting and sustained starvation. And I was a teenager, and my hair was falling out in clumps. During a 10th grade class trip, this one for 7 days in Minnesota, my diet consisted of a handful of trail mix each day. One evening, after hiking and trust falling, I stayed in the tent while the rest of my classmates grilled hamburgers and hot dogs for dinner. The smell of charred meat coming from the barbecues outside didn't make me hungry so much as tired. As I lay on my sleeping bag staring at the tent's thin walls, a soft light filtered in. The sun hadn't even begun to set. To the sounds of cicadas and laughing in the distance, I fell asleep. When we got back to Chicago, my dad, not my mom, picked me up. He hadn't been called or warned. No one had noticed I hadn't eaten. The next morning, under the pretense of going shopping, something we rarely did, my mom and I headed downtown in a cab. The cab headed east and eventually pulled up in front of a circular building that was part of Northwestern Memorial Hospital. My mother paid the fare. We got out of the cab. On the way up the escalator, we didn't speak. We entered the eating disorders unit. The waiting room's walls were painted a deep blue. The fabric of the chairs frayed at the edges. I imagined how many other girls had sat there. Eventually, a nurse called my name. In the examination room, she told me to undress and put on a gown. I did. She directed me to step on the scale, 92 pounds. Then she took my labs. Blood tests, heart rate, blood pressure. The therapist, a young man in his 30s, reminded me of Sherman from The Best Little Girl in the World. So, unlike Dr. S, he seemed interested. I asked if he'd be my doctor. He smiled and said no. As my mom and I waited, we both stared straight ahead at the blue wall. The assistant director of the eating disorders unit called us into her office. She wore her hair twisted in a banana bun and was very thin. We sat in the two chairs opposite her desk. The assistant director said I'd be admitted to the intensive outpatient program. This wasn't, I learned, good news. It was like being put on probation. I'd be at the hospital 4 days a week after school for individual and family therapy sessions and meetings with a nutritionist. No medications. Few anorexics were treated with psychotropic drugs back then. She warned that only one thing would keep me out of the hospital: my lab results. My potassium, electrolyte levels, and blood pressure, all of which could drop dangerously low if I continued to behave the way I was, had to remain stable. Self-denial takes many forms. In the 17th century, it was defined as the opposite of self-love. Some say it's about patience, others control. It can be punishing. To some, it's virtuous, an act of renunciation. In religion, it arises out of the desire to find salvation or be redeemed or serve others. It's about faith or spiritual reflection or asceticism or a monkish devotion to abstinence or the piety that drives the devout to abstain out of a love for God. Sometimes it's touted as an achievement. Pop psychologists and sociologists have long reported, incorrectly, that self-denial in childhood makes us more successful as adults. It doesn't. The oft-cited 1990s Stanford marshmallow study supposedly showed that if you promised a child a second marshmallow if they waited 15 minutes before eating the first, and the child waited, they would excel in life. The study was flawed. A 2018 experiment that attempted to replicate it found instead that the correlation between self-denial and success vanished almost entirely once researchers controlled for socioeconomic status. Our views of self-denial are sexist. It's powerful when a man does it, irrational and shallow when a woman does. But it is powerful, even to a 16-year-old girl. My psychologist, Laura, had short black hair that curled around her chin. Sitting in a chair beside her desk, I pictured her in high school, an A student, not popular but well-liked. Light from the window streamed in as she asked about my anorectic behavior. Was I spitting out my food or measuring my calves or considering taping batteries between my thighs on weigh days? I took these as suggestions and treated them like homework assignments. It started to feel like a game. Except it wasn't. My nails were brittle, my skin dry and cakey. My energy was sapped from not eating. I'd sit in class, my eyes drooping, and try not to fall asleep. My grades had started to slip and then plummet. When I studied, my books seemed gauzy, the words on their pages remote. She asked how I was doing in school. Good, I said. Good. To confirm my diagnosis, Laura would have flipped through the pages of the DSM-3. As one of the original diagnoses to appear in the DSM-1, anorexia was first described as a psychophysiologic gastrointestinal reaction to stress. Over its many editions, the DSM added subtypes and new food-related behaviors to create an eating disorders spectrum that allowed more people to receive a diagnosis. The DSM's 3 and 3R adopted bulimia nervosa, binging and purging. The DSM's 4 and 4TR added the subtype eating disorder not otherwise specified, EDNOS. The DSM-5 made eating disorders a separate chapter, feeding and eating disorders, removed EDNOS, and added a bounty of subtypes, rumination disorder, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, other specified eating or feeding disorder, unspecified eating or feeding disorder, and the dubious binge eating disorder. Laura and I were in the DSM-3 era. Psychiatry was supposedly on its way to being a respected field of medicine. Laura would have been confident in the DSM's claims. She might not have known its diagnoses were only more reliable than they'd been in previous editions, which was almost not at all, and that clinicians had complained the diagnostic criteria were unwieldy and arbitrary and didn't apply to patients in the real world. As diagnoses go, anorexia was a pretty safe bet. It's hard to deny. It's so physical, so visible. My skeletal body, my sharp cheekbones, the peach fuzz covering my abdomen. Time seemed to drag, but also to speed by. Some mornings I woke and washed my face and started to dress for school, only to realize that most of the semester had passed. The due date for my 10th grade term paper was weeks away, and then a week away, and then a handful of days. I couldn't even make it through the assigned text, Fyodor Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. As I lay on my bed reading the novel, the words blurred on the page. Scene after scene unfolded. The characters rambled on about I didn't know what. A classmate told me it was about an antisocial, impoverished ex-student, Raskolnikov, who robs and kills an old woman and her sister with an axe and has an existential breakdown as he deliberates whether he should regret what he's done. By the end, his self-justification falls apart. Religion sparks a reawakening, and he sees the pointlessness of his crime. Right, I said. I turned one of the final pages and stopped. The skin on the back of my right hand was dry and cracked. Blood seeped from my knuckles. Startled, I sat up. The room seemed to fall away. Everything went black. Writing the paper didn't go well either. I tried to analyze the imagery, but my thoughts chased each other in circles. I didn't know what I was saying. On the screen of our family computer, a clunky beige Macintosh Plus, was a jumble of words and punctuation. A week later, the assistant dean pulled me from history class and told me Mr. Baker wanted to see me. I walked through the empty hallways toward his office. At my last visit to the eating disorders unit, I hadn't gained much weight, and although my potassium level remained steady, my blood pressure was very low. I reached Mr. Baker's office and knocked on the open door. He was in his wheelchair at his desk with his back to me. The windowless office he shared with another teacher barely fit two desks and two chairs. I sat in the chair beside him. He adjusted his thin legs and handed me my paper. I skipped to the last page. In the middle was scrawled an F in red pen. The litany of errors he'd written was long. The absence of topic sentences, lack of a clear argument, etc. He said I seemed not to know what the book was about. "And then," he said, an exasperated expression coming over his face, "there's the way you use commas." He shook his head, dismayed, "like you're decorating a Christmas tree." He said I could rewrite the paper, but it better be good. I reread Crime and Punishment, and I ate, little bits at a time. Crackers, a slice of cheese, a baked potato. My stomach cramped and ached from being stretched. The novel was still hard to follow. The Russian names sounded too similar or too foreign to take in, but I managed to understand it well enough to write about the deterioration of Raskolnikov's mind. I typed and typed, trying to describe his mental tirades and how he makes himself ill by tormenting himself with circular arguments about what he's done. All that was left were commas. I'd barely thought of commas. They joined something and split something else, but who knew why? My grammar book was like a foreign language, subjunctive clauses, appositives, summative modifiers. Until then, my approach had been to wing it, a dot here, a dash there. It only had to sound right. I didn't know it then, but the comma was punctuating my life as an anorexic. It separated items in the list of ways I was falling apart. Dry skin, brittle nails, difficulty concentrating, exhaustion. It set off information I deemed unimportant. My symptoms, which included muscle weakness and fainting, were severe. It coordinated adjectives that described me, the thin, depressed girl. It marked an introductory phrase. Once upon a time, there was a very thin girl. It created dependent relationships. Although my family tried to help, I kept getting worse. It connected independent clauses. I got worse, and my family was worried. The comma didn't always look as it does today. In Aristophanes of Byzantium's three-dot system, the middle dot, which became the comma, indicated the briefest pause, just long enough to take a breath, where the sentence was incomplete. In the late 15th century, the Italian scholar and publisher Aldus Minutius gave us the low-hanging semicircular shape we now have. Some say he lowered the slash, which had been used to separate words. Others say he put a tail on the period. Either way, people eventually started to use it incorrectly as a way to pause. Not so. That's true for the reader, but not the writer. Each person might pause at a different moment when writing a sentence. I didn't understand the comma's importance, how it clarifies and connects, so I'd used it incorrectly. In my appositive, Sarah, comma, an anorexic, I'd formed irrational lists of target weights, calorie limits, glasses of water to fill my empty stomach. I joined thoughts that didn't belong together, clauses illogically linked, I'm hungry, but I shouldn't eat, and irrational ideas subordinated. If that bite of toast touches my lips, I'll gain 50 pounds. The weekend after I turned in the paper, my friend Ryan, a junior, called me at home and said he had a present for me. He was round-faced and sociable, one of those people who was friends with everyone. He drove over in his parents' car. Once I was in the passenger seat, he handed me a cardboard box. Inside was a kitten, a Siamese tortoiseshell point with mottled beige and brown fur and soft blue eyes. She let out a high-pitched, sweet meow. My mom wasn't pleased. We already had two cats I didn't feed and clean up after, but she didn't make me go back out to the car and give the kitten back. I named the kitten Cappy. She fit in my two hands with just her tail hanging over. That night, she slept in the crook of my neck where she could feel my heartbeat, steady and slow. That Monday in class, Mr. Baker handed me my paper. I don't remember the grade, but it was decent, and I was flagged to go on to 11th grade. In his comments, he thanked me for my diurnal and nocturnal efforts. I had to look up both words. He meant he could tell how hard I'd worked on it, day and night. More than that, he said, I'd used commas mostly right. Summer came. One afternoon, I sat alone in a booth in Mitchell's, a diner-ish restaurant near my high school. It was relatively empty of customers. The waitress stood at my table and scribbled my order of a grilled blueberry muffin, the house specialty, on her order pad. I handed her the plastic-encased menu. She smiled and started to walk toward the kitchen. To her, I might have been any teenage girl having a sweet treat. A normal girl. A girl who ate what she wanted and didn't obsess about food and her body. But my mind was still in a loop. The grill, the liquid butter, the muffin, the calories, the fat. The best little girl in the world offered me a way in, but no way out. Kessa's descent into anorexia is clearly plotted, her ascent out of anorexia less so. Recovery occupies a scant 35 of the book's 250 pages. Sherman, the heroic therapist, saves her by getting her to open up to him about her feelings. He sits with her while she eats, allowing him to observe her compulsive behaviors and rituals around food, cutting her piece of toast into halves and then quarters and only eating a quarter, tapping her fingers on the side of her chair and silently chanting her name to four syllabic beats, four being the magic number that would keep her from gaining weight. In the end, it's still unclear whether she'll end up in the hospital again. After a while, the waitress came over and put down the plate with the blueberry muffin in front of me. I imagined how one of the cooks had sliced it in half, slabbed liquid butter on it, and placed it on the grill. She asked if I needed anything else. I started to cry and hurriedly shook my head. The muffin lay on the plate in half, each grilled side oozing butter. I picked up my knife and fork and, like Kessa, cut the muffin into halves and then quarters. Slowly, I took a bite. 2. Consider the colon. My boyfriend, Chris, went out to the vegetable garden in our backyard and returned with two armfuls of freshly picked yellow squash. They're going to go bad, he said with a smile, and set to work in the kitchen. The apartment we shared was perfect. A two-bedroom and a two-flat in a not-quite-gentrified neighborhood in Chicago. No one lived in the apartment upstairs. It was like having our own little house. The wood floors were beat up, and the shabby windows drafted frigid air in the winters. But it had a big kitchen, a dining room, and what seemed to us like a huge backyard. Our lives revolved around food-related areas. The kitchen, where Chris cooked. The dining room, where we had dinners with friends, and the garden. It was his idea to grow vegetables. The garden bordered an abandoned lot on one side and an alley on the other. Only a barbed wire fence protected the garden from the cars that sped past, kicking up gravel and dirt and trash. We were so proud of it. In part, it was a response to the limited options for groceries. The local grocery store sold aisles upon aisles of canned food, 10-pound portions of frozen chuck roast, and wilting iceberg lettuce that was often out of stock. We answered with plentiful harvests of zucchini, thyme, and cilantro. Too much basil and too many tomatoes meant we ate balsamic tomato basil salads for days in a row. Chicago had its first Whole Foods, but compared to our homegrown peppers, theirs looked almost artificial in the glare of the store's fluorescent lights. That afternoon, while Chris cooked the yellow squash, I took a bath. Our deep clawfoot tub wasn't perfect. Scratches flecked its porcelain finish. One of the lion's feet had broken off and been replaced by an iron stub and wood chips to level it. But the baths it gave enveloped and warmed me. I wasn't cold anymore, and I'd stopped starving myself. It had happened slowly, taking almost a decade. My freshman year in college, I fell into that strange limbo of eating just enough junk food to keep me bloated and not exactly thin, not eating all day and then giving in to cravings for salty chips and sugary cookies. I'd throw in a sandwich or a salad to make it look like a meal. Disordered eating, maybe, but nothing the eating disorders unit would have taken notice of. Becoming a women's studies major gave me a deeper sense of myself. I wrote essays on the male gaze and protested violence against women in Take Back the Night marches. My brain teemed with thoughts of misogyny and internalized sexism and gender performativity. I learned how the patriarchy and big business and advertising and the media make women believe we were put on this earth to buy uncomfortable lingerie and trap men into marriage. I shaved my head. My long, light brown hair that once reached the middle of my back became stubble. During the late shifts I worked at the campus deli, the drunk frat boys who'd once come in and hit on me, always in a creepy, taunting way, now seemed not to notice me. I was, in my unfemininity, invisible to them. And it was a relief. Then I read Joan Jacobs Brumberg's Fasting Girls, and my relationship to food and my body shifted. Brumberg wrote about women who retreated from society and denied themselves food as acts of defiance and assertions of their rights. During the Middle Ages, women like Catherine of Siena, Marjorie Kemp, and Julian of Norwich voluntarily emaciated themselves, their hunger making them so weak they hallucinated that God and/or Jesus visited them. The public saw them as mystics or saints, many going to them to be blessed, which undermined and angered the priesthood. After the Reformation, miraculous maids put their starvation on display to earn a living at a time when women had no economic rights. People paid to see them. It was the same in Victorian England, when fasting girls became a sensation in the press. Brumberg stressed the difference between voluntary fasting for a purpose and anorexia. The book changed how I saw what I'd been doing. Those women were radical. I was senseless. It helped that the eating disorders unit was far away. No one was around to remind me that I had anorexia. No longer defined by my yeah, no longer thinking in the appositive, Sarah, comma, the anorexic, I stopped believing I was one. While in the bath, I left the door open so I could hear Chris chop onions and click the burners on the stove and run the water in the kitchen sink. Cappy came in, meowed, rubbed against the tub, and walked out. I didn't ask Chris what kind of soup he was making out of all that squash. I'd eat what was given. His relationship with food was one of devotion. When he cooked, each cube of bouillon, every clove of garlic deserved respect. He ate healthy meals, usually stopped when he was full, and didn't manipulate or fear food the way I had. On our days off, he'd cook all afternoon, making big batches of potato leek or white bean and fennel soup. Soup was the staple of our diet, mainly because it was cheap. I finished my bath and dressed and sat on the couch to read. Our life together was simple. We had no internet. The TV stayed in the closet and was only brought out to watch the occasional show. We worked nights in the service industry, he as a bartender, I as a server. During the day and on our nights off, he wrote songs and performed with an avant-garde theater company on the South Side, and I wrote strange, ethereal short stories no one read. In our social circles, without social media, we didn't hunger for money and fame. It was the 1990s. Being indie was still possible, not watered down by the flatness of the internet, where all albums, major or indie, well-funded or on a shoestring, look the same. To Chris, the pinnacle of success was to be signed to the indie record label Thrill Jockey, which produced bands like The Sea and Cake and Tortoise. I thought only of writing, not about getting published, and knew nothing about MFA programs and agents. We just wanted the next day to be as good as the one before. There was a sense of plenty. Rent was affordable. Our furniture and clothes were almost all secondhand. We didn't buy stuff. Most of our money went to CDs and books, under $10 bottles of wine, groceries, and food and catnip for Cappy. Chris called me to the kitchen. On the table sat two steaming bowls of pureed yellow squash soup. It didn't matter that it was warm out. We sat kitty-corner to each other. 7 years older than I was, he was genuine and cool and talented and funny. My family loved him. My mother, my father, my stepmother, my sister, my brother-in-law. And his love for me was palpable. I'd never had anyone give of themselves the way Chris did. Early in our relationship, after finishing a solo hiking trip of a section of the Appalachian Trail, he drove his VW bus all night to be with me as soon as he could. He lifted his spoon and blew on his soup to cool it. I put my hand on his free hand and gently squeezed. He lowered his spoon to the bowl and wove his fingers through mine. "Thank you," I said, my eyes tearing up. He tilted his head, clearly surprised by the emotion squash soup had evoked in me. "You're welcome." I raised our joined hands to my lips and kissed the back of his hand. So much had changed. I was cured. The word cure doesn't mean what we think it means. The primary definition is to take care of. In that sense, I was cured. I'd learned to take care of myself. What we think of when we read the word cure is the secondary definition that appears in the Oxford English Dictionary. Someone being healed from a disease. It first appeared in Wycliffe's Bible in reference to physical diseases. It wasn't until the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries that we started to believe in cures for emotions like love, grief, and desire.